From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this episode, a defense lawyer for the military commissions at Guantanamo resigns and condemns the system he served.
The U.S. is giving a license for the rest of the world to torture, to set up secret military courts outside of due process.
A novel that examines the toll of Sri Lanka's civil war.
What I wanted to do was really try to depict what happens to normal people in the course of warfare.
The latest in our series, My Big Break, An Auctioneer's Rise.
45 minutes after my mom had got done auctioneering, she went into labor with me. I was pert near born in a livestock market. It's that serious.
GoPro made it even easier to attach the camera to your pet.
Whoa, that was so rowdy!
Rock and roll history in 10 songs, but not the usual suspects.
Any good rock and roll song can tell the story of rock and roll.
And Ty Siegel stops by our studios to rock out acoustic style.
I seen the grin in the belly of your eyes.
That's all on this podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. Army Major Jason Wright joined the U.S. military in 2005. He served 15 months in Iraq during the surge and has worked as a judge advocate. In 2011, the military appointed him to the defense team for one of the highest-profile defendants in the world, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks. Mohammed is facing a military commission at Guantanamo Bay. If convicted, he could be executed. This past week, Major Wright resigned from the Army and left the defense team. The Army pulled him off the Mohammed case in order to complete a required graduate course. More on that in a moment. But when I spoke to Wright this week, I asked him how he could effectively represent a client like Mohammed, and if it's possible to gain his trust.
Well, I think it's hard to gain any client's trust. But if you add on to the complexities when it comes to the so-called high-value detainees, now there's six high-value detainees who are currently being prosecuted for death penalty offenses. All six of these men have been tortured by the U.S. government. Now, with respect to Mr. Mohammed, you're looking at a level of torture that is just beyond comprehension. He was waterboarded by the CIA 183 times. He was subjected to over a week of sleep deprivation. There were threats to kill his family. And those are just the declassified facts that I'm able to actually speak about. When you show up several years later and you say, I'm from the U.S. government and I'm here to help you, you add on the complexity that I wear the same uniform as the guards. So it's very challenging in any situation to develop trust and confidence with a client. But when you add on that torture paradigm, it's all the more difficult.
And when it comes to the detainee abuse that you're talking about, which the defense has made fairly central in the proceeding, you're sort of restrained in how you can talk about that in court, right?
We are. I read an interesting article today by Laura Pitter.
From Human Rights Watch.
Human Rights Watch, and she wrote it in Foreign Policy. And it was an interesting phrase that the entire military commissions process has been affected by the original sin. And the original sin being the fact that the CIA tortured these men and that they've gone to extraordinary lengths to try to keep that completely hidden from public view. So the statute that Congress passed has a number of protections to ensure that no information about the U.S. torture program will ever come out. You add on to that how the commissions have actually operate in practice, and there are a number of constraints that have been applied upon the defense and the defense teams throughout this process. We have allegations that have been established that there were listening devices in our attorney-client meeting rooms. There were disguised smoke detectors. There were, in fact, listening devices. You have the FBI, as of spring of this year, trying to infiltrate one of our defense teams. So not only do you have a statutory design, but you actually have in practice a very large effort to try to ensure that no information about torture is ever made known in public. So it's really has been an original sin that has affected the entire course of the proceedings.
And as you say, there's been a whole laundry list of complaints from the defense teams for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the co-defendants. What's been the hardest part of that for you as a defense lawyer to deal with?
I think the hardest part to deal with is just knowing that the U.S. government is trying to call this a fair trial while stacking the deck so much against the defense and the accused that it can hardly be called a fair trial in any system in the world. But I think if we take a step back and think about the larger strategic implications of this, is that the U.S. is giving a license for the rest of the world to torture, They're giving a license to other countries to set up secret military courts outside of public review and outside of due process. Leave aside our constitutional principles, which we should try to uphold irrespective of who the defendant may be. The Constitution has been completely stepped on throughout this entire process. That's a separate and distinct issue of how the U.S. now has shown just abhorrent leadership when it comes to actually following essential fundamental human rights and due process guarantees.
Well, what you've described sounds kind of like a show trial.
I think that's a fair description. And at the end of the day, if there is a trial for the 9/11 co-defendants, the U.S. government has essentially stated that under no circumstances would they actually be released. So in other words, if there was a not guilty verdict, the U.S. government still would not release them. Contrast this with Nuremberg, where Justice Jackson, the chief prosecutor at the time, was asked that question. He said, absolutely, if these Nazi war criminals are acquitted, they will be set free. We have a system where if someone's acquitted, they will not be set free. That is actually the very definition of a show trial.
Jason, how did you find out you were being taken off of this case?
Well, I'm a judge advocate, and I've been in the Army now for 9 years. At least I was in the Army for 9 years. Whenever a judge advocate in the Army is promoted from captain to major, they have to attend a one-year graduate course. Now, this graduate course can be deferred for operational or personal reasons, and according to policy, there's no limit to the number of deferrals that you can request and receive. So I came out on the list to attend the graduate course last year, and I requested a deferral for 1 year, and that was granted. I came out on the list again this year, and I requested a deferral, and this time it was denied without explanation. So really, I only had two choices. I could either accept and voluntarily leave my own self from the case and my obligations to my client, or I could refuse the orders. And in this instance, I decided that it would be an ethical violation for me to voluntarily abandon a capitally charged client in active litigation, so I declined the orders. I refused the orders. And when you refuse the orders, you have to resign from the Army.
How is your departure going to affect the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed defense?
Well, I believe it's going to be very disrupting. Here you have government attorneys who tell a defendant, I'm your attorney, I'm here to help you, and I'm going to be here till the end. And halfway through this process, the U.S. government, the same government that tortures you, the same government that's trying to kill you, the same government that provides the public defender, now gets to control when defense attorneys come and go. So I think it's going to have a demonstrable effect on the outcome, at the very least, of the defense team for Mr. Mohammed and perhaps the other co-defendants as well, to know that the U.S. government is going to continue to control all aspects of their lives, even their own defense for their very own lives.
Former Army Major Jason Wright. We asked the Pentagon to comment on Wright's interview with us. A spokesman for the Army told us that, quote, the judge advocate general denied the second deferral request because a suitable and competent military defense attorney replacement was available, Major Wright was not the leader's sole counsel, and it ensured Major Wright remained professionally competent and competitive for promotion, unquote. A spokesman for the military commissions also disputes Major Wright's characterization of the commission, saying, quote, the prosecution has never listened to a single attorney-client communication, and no entity of the U.S. government is listening to, monitoring, or recording attorney-client communications at the detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, unquote. There are ongoing investigations into allegations that the FBI attempted to turn a member of a detainee's legal team into a confidential informant. The government also disputes Wright's claim that the proceedings amount to a show trial, saying, quote, the ongoing detention of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is fully consistent with the law of armed conflict, and that detention is reviewable by petition for habeas corpus in United States federal civilian court, unquote. They also point to the convicted detainees who have served out their sentences and returned to their home countries. You can read the full statements from the military on our website, npr.org. It's hard to comprehend the toll Sri Lanka's civil war took on the South Asian country. The UN estimates that between 80 and 100,000 people lost their lives in the conflict, all on an island just slightly larger than West Virginia. Tensions between the two main ethnic groups in Sri Lanka, the majority Sinhalese and minority Tamils, simmered through the 60s and 70s, and a full-on war between government forces and militants called the Tamil Tigers broke out in 1983. the war didn't end until government forces eradicated the Tamil Tigers in 2009. During the war years, tens of thousands of Sri Lankans, both Tamil and Sinhalese, left the island. Naomi Munavera was one. Her family left in the 1970s for Nigeria and arrived in the U.S. in 1984. Munavera's new novel about the conflict and its effects on Sri Lankan families is called Island of a Thousand Mirrors. It mostly follows one Sinhalese girl who is an eyewitness to the horror.
What I wanted to do in this book was really try to depict what happens to normal people in the course of warfare and how your life can be completely derailed by this. So I was very interested in not taking a side, or I wasn't interested in propaganda. So I wanted to show what happened to normal people. And this is actually something that I've read about and heard about. Tamil people at various points have been asked to prove that they're Sinhalese or when the mobs come. And of course, the opposite too. The devastation happened on both sides. The Tamil Tigers were really brutal terrorist force and killed hundreds and thousands of people. And the Sri Lankan government did exactly the same thing. So both sides are complicit. There's really no innocence here.
And the family, or part of the family in this book, they decide to leave the island, leaving their extended family behind. And there's some serious culture shock in the book when the family ends up in America, in Los Angeles. Talk about their experience.
I think that might be where I take the most from my own life, because I came here in 84 when I was 12 years old. And it's just startling to be in America. Everything is different. I mean, I remember like seeing somebody walking their dogs and then picking up the poo in a bag and like, oh my God, what are they doing with that? Like, wow, we're in the richest country in the world and is she saving it? Like, what does that mean? I mean,
so you mentioned you are Sinhalese yourself, but you didn't want to have a narrow perspective for this book. And sure enough, about 2/3 of the way through the novel, the viewpoint switches to a young Tamil girl named Saraswati.
Right.
She's abducted and brutalized by a group of Sinhalese soldiers. Can you talk about her radicalization? I'm wondering if it was difficult for you to put yourself inside the head of a militant.
Right, right. One of the questions that drove me is, what makes someone do this? Because Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers especially, were known for suicide bombings and specifically female suicide bombers. In fact, each Tamil Tiger cadre had a capsule of cyanide that they wore around their necks. Mm-hmm. So if they were caught, they would immediately commit suicide. So suicide was very much part of their sort of culture. And so there were this cadre of female suicide bombers, which, you know, are quite rare in the world. And I really wanted to try and find out, like, what would make someone do that? And at the end of the day, it wasn't that difficult to imagine, because if everything is taken away from you, and I don't want to give away too much, but she is taken away, she is brutalized, and then when she returns home, she's not accepted really by her community anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like her choices dwindle more and more. That part of the book, that specific part, was really difficult to write. It was painful research, and a lot of readers tell me that was hard to read. But, you know, this is what would make someone militarized. This is what would make someone willing to sacrifice their lives. It has to be difficult, you know?
So it's not a spoiler to reveal, obviously, that the war in Sri Lanka ended, and that's covered in this book. But it ended brutally. I mean, it involved the government really just kind of stomping the Tamil Tigers out of existence. And in the book, the characters don't quite know how to process it, the end.
Right. I have to say that was because I finished writing this book at the moment that the war ended. Actually, I finished writing this book about 2007. And it ended at a different place. Mm-hmm. And it felt unfinished. But, I mean, you know, I grew up with this war. It's been since 83. So for me, and I think many, many young Sri Lankans, we didn't expect that we would ever see the end of this war. We thought that this would always be something that was happening. And then in 2009, I'm like, oh, like right when everything happened and it ended is when I wrote that final piece. And it does end on a hopeful note. I think also because as a writer, I just couldn't make myself go through any more pain with it. So I think a different book, maybe a different author needs to take up. Maybe I will take it up at some point. But what happens post-war?
Naomi Munavera's new novel is called Island of a Thousand Mirrors, and it is coming out this week in the United States. Naomi, thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
For years now, people equipped with durable GoPro cameras have been shooting videos from the front of a surfboard or the tip of a ski and posting them online. And starting this week, GoPro made it even easier to attach the camera to your pet. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has the story.
Dude!
Here's a typical mega-popular YouTube video shot with GoPro cameras. Guy's climbing a desert cliff.
This is scary, man.
Guy sees precarious-looking zipline hundreds of feet above a canyon floor.
This looks so damn scary, dude.
But this guy is not going to let this line go unzipped.
Are ready? Ready, steady. Spaghetti.
And with the vicarious thrill of YouTube, we can all fly above the canyon together.
Yeah! That was so scary!
This type of video is GoPro's bread and butter. From extreme sports like dirt biking...
Oh my God!
...to backcountry skiing or urban kayaking...
Whoa, that was so rowdy!
What makes these videos possible are the highly durable, waterproof HD cameras... and the mounts, which allow people to attach those cameras to a helmet, a ski, a surfboard, or a dog. The latest mount released this week is called the GoPro Fetch, and it was designed by this guy.
My name is Josh Drucker. I'm manager of the Advanced Mounts Group here at GoPro.
In fact, Drucker leads a 5-person team with basically one job, create cool new ways to attach GoPro cameras to different stuff.
Yes, I have one of the best jobs in the world.
The idea for a dog mount actually came from GoPro users who were finding all sorts of ways to record a dog's eye view. So Drucker says the company did a lot of field testing to create an official harness that would fit all shapes and sizes.
It's not just size testing that you're looking for, it's kind of the skeletal structure underneath. Like Dobermans are very angular and narrow, whereas you take something like a Newfoundland and it's very broad and hairy.
Now, Josh Drucker is himself not a dog owner.
I am not a dog owner, but I have 2 kids. I won't say that I put the harness on them.
But you're not saying it.
Yes. There may be some therapy later where this comes up.
So kids, dogs, a really friendly cat. This new harness could fit a lot of different stuff.
All right, come on.
Even a pig that surfs.
Where's your favorite surf spot? Sandy Beach?
That's one of GoPro's proudest users, Kai Holt, and his surfing pig, Kama.
He doesn't even know.
And while you might not believe there's really a pig that can stand on a surfboard in the Pacific, there it is, caught on camera. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
The new book, A History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs, is missing just about everything you might expect. There's no Rolling Stone songs, no Jimi Hendrix performances or long meditations on Woodstock. Musicologist Greil Marcus ignores the iconic in favor of 10 songs he says tell the wild story of one of America's greatest gifts to the world. Number one is Shake Some Action by the Flamin' Groovies, which Marcus calls a name so stupid it's embarrassing to say out loud. And there's so much more to say about the song. It's got a beat that just won't let you stop listening, which is so rock and roll. Greil Marcus, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
So let's jump into this list with number two. That's the 1979 post-punk anthem Transmission by the British band Joy Division. What's the British post-punk have to do with American rock and roll sensibilities?
When I listen to Joy Division, it doesn't sound specifically English, and particularly the song I wrote about, Transmission, is just an example of the way that a song can start out seemingly controlled, seemingly orderly, and then blow apart to the point where you can't imagine that it could ever end, that it could ever reach any kind of resolution, whether it's musical or spiritual or in any other form. And yet it does.
Dance.
You know, writing this book, choosing songs, I didn't try to find the best or the most representative or the most anything. It was simply a group of songs, each of which, in its own way, could contain the whole notion of what rock and roll is and really, more importantly, what it can do to a performer, what it can do to a listener.
Number 4 is a particular favorite of mine, the Etta James song, All I Could Do Was Cry. Let's hear a little bit of that first.
Great.
I heard church bells ringing. I heard a choir singing.
I heard church bells ringing. That's the opening line. It's a song about a woman whose man is marrying somebody else. I heard, that's the whole song. Just in those two words, the way Etta James is able to get so many intimations of resignation, anger. So much of rock and roll comes down to these tiny little moments when an artist is able to put absolutely everything that she has, that she knows, into that. And those are the things that stick with us. Could I express as much in a 10-minute song as she expresses in 2 seconds?
To us, each word was a pain in my heart.
Moving on now to song number 5. This is just a beautiful little song. Crying, Waiting, Hoping, originally by Buddy Holly and then later covered by the Beatles. Now, I have this impression, no doubt, from the various rock histories that you kind of criticize in your book, that basically all rock and roll lives in the shadow of Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly had something very different from the other great early rock and roll stars. He came across as so ordinary, such a nerd. He's got these big glasses, and he looks like the sort of person that, you know, every time he opened his locker, you'd slam it closed in his face. And Buddy Holly never lost that demeanor, that I could be you, you could be me. But Crying, Waiting, Hoping, this is just a song that he had written, that he records into his home tape recorder. When you listen to it today, it's shocking just how clear the sound is, how strong the singing is, and yet modest. And it's a perfect song.
Crying, my tears keep a falling all night long. Waiting, it feels so useless, I know it's wrong to keep a crying. Waiting, hoping you'll come back. Maybe someday soon things will change and you'll be mine.
Grilla, I want to talk about one more song in the book. To Know Him Is to Love Him. It was written in 1958 by Phil Spector, originally performed by the Teddy Bears. And honestly, you know, the original version, it sounds pretty corny.
To know.
And then you turn me on to the Amy Winehouse version, which is extraordinary. What did she do with this song?
Well, here are the Teddy Bears in 1958. Very corny little doo-wop song, overwhelmingly sentimental. It's really kind of simpering. It becomes a number one national hit. And then, you know, after the song wears out on the radio, people are kind of embarrassed by it. They don't really want to think about it. So, you know, years after Amy Winehouse died, I guess it was in early 2013. Her record company put out an album called Amy Winehouse at the BBC, and I'm driving in my car, I'm listening to the radio, and this comes on.
To know him.
And again, it's like Etta James with I Heard. This is to know him is to love him. And I do. It's the beginning of the song. But it's all there in that to know. I was just devastated that she could take this song as if it had never been heard and put it into the world for the first time, even after she was gone.
Oh, I'll be good to him. I'll bring joy to him. Oh, everyone says there'll come a day when I walk alongside of him.
Greil, for the people at home who are shouting at their radios right now, things like, how could you not have a chapter on Rock Around the Clock or Purple Haze or Smells Like Teen Spirit? What do you say to them?
I'd say that, you know, we don't need the songs that most people know as a way of opening the door to the question of why we're so moved by this music. For that matter, I hate Rock Around the Clock. I didn't like it when I was 10 years old. I don't like it now. But the whole argument is that any good rock and roll song can tell the story of rock and roll.
Greil Marcus's new book is The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs. We didn't get to all 10 here. You can hear more on our website, npr.org. Greil, real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Well, it was great talking with you. I had a really good time.
Sweeter than wine. Softer than a summer's night. Everything I wanna have. Whenever I hold you tight.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs, big and small. And this time, we're headed down to a cattle auction.
50, sir, to get $1.52.
Firing off prices from the auction block in a sharp suit and cowboy hat sits Blaine Lotz from Edna, Kansas. This year, he won first place at the World Livestock Auctioneer Championship, the Super Bowl of auctioneering. And he's only 21 years old.
Just about anybody you ask, they can about tell you what they think an auctioneer is, and it's always a fast talker. But more, it's really more than that. I'm the big taker. I am the middleman. I'm the agent between buyer and seller. There's a million and a half things going on at once, but that's what makes it so much fun. I mean, there's no downtime. Everything is just on it. I mean, if you have some downtime, you should be doing something.
249.
Years ago, my grandfather started the generations of the auctioneer, and later on, Mom came along, and she incorporated livestock auctions, but she also did auctions with my grandfather. Anyhow, on down the road, Mom got to where she was selling livestock markets, and this was probably when she was 25 to 35 years old. It just so happened she was in Diamond, Missouri selling, and walked up the stairs with my dad, and he was buying cattle. My dad is a cattle order buyer. It just kind of went off from there. Dad bought cattle, Mom sold cattle, and I was born right into the business. In fact, 45 minutes after my mom had got done auctioneering, she went into labor with me. I was pert near born in a livestock market. It's that serious. Mom always told me that my lullaby was the auction chant. She didn't sing to me or do anything else. She auctioneered to me. And I guess it sunk in because by the time I was 4 years old, the only thing I could think of was cattle and a livestock market. In fact, I learned to count cattle at a feed bunk. That's the way I learned to count, was when they were all lined up to eat. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. By the time I was 15 years old, Mom told me that she wanted to take me to auctioneer school, and I said, oh, I'm all over that. I definitely want to do that. Western College of Auctioneering in Billings, Montana. They advertise it as the Cadillac of auction colleges. The way they taught you how to auctioneer was via number drills and tongue twisters. Tongue twister that I certainly enjoy is called Betty Botter. Betty Botter bought some butter, but she said this butter's bitter. If I put it in my batter, it will make my batter bitter. So she bought a bit of better butter, put it in her bitter batter, made her bitter batter better, so 'tis better Betty Botter bought a bit of better butter. And now to this day, every time before I get up to sell to develop rhythm, I seduce Betty Botter. As Betty bought her rods and butter, but she said it's butter bitter. If I put it in my batter, they won't make my batter bitter. So she bought a bit of better butter, put it in her bitter batter, made her bitter batter better. So does better Betty bought her, bought a bit of better butter. In July of 2009, I sold at my first auction. My big break was the first year I competed in the qualifying rounds for the World Livestock Auctioneer Championship. That's where it all started. I went straight for the world contest. I never did compete in any other competitions or championships, just only the World Livestock Auctioneer Championship. Just be at 18 years of age, it just shocked me to death when I was standing there. And then when the first place rang, they named my name, and I just could not believe it. Sure, sure, I'll do some chants. Alrighty. $500, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $
That's Blaine Lotz, the 21-year-old World Livestock Auctioneer Champion. You don't have to be an auctioneer to have a big break. We want to hear your story. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org.
I've got to make my mark and be an auctioneer. $25 bid, and now $30, $30, will they give me 30, make it 30 bid, upon my $30, will they give me 30, who would bid a $30 bid?
Brace yourself for a goofy music analogy. But if there's a Mozart of garage rock, it's Ty Segall. He's put out at least a dozen albums of face-melting, critic-adored lo-fi rock in the style of bands like the Troggs or the Stooges, not to mention his work in several other bands and other collaborations in a ton of different styles. And he's barely 27 years old. But his newest album, Manipulator, is something different. Manipulator is much more polished and produced. Ty Segall's a Southern California boy, so he came by our studios at NPR West, guitar in hand, planning to, in his words, rock out acoustic style. I started by asking him why these songs weren't as rough around the edges.
Yeah, there's only so many times you can, you know, make a record on a 4-track or an 8-track, and we were really lucky to have the opportunity this time to go into a studio for like a month. So it's very rare these days that you have an opportunity if you're not like signed to a big label or, you know, you don't have a bunch of money. It's very rare to get an opportunity like that, so it's like, let's go for it, you know.
But would you say with this new album, I mean, you didn't just take longer to produce it in the studio, that there's a different sound here, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I took twice as long to write it than I've usually done. I'm a pretty impatient person with myself. I like to, at least in the past, like first takes the take, or try to do stuff live with a band a lot. You know, I think there's a beauty in non-perfectionism, like all the old records that are just like Louie is just like, the guy screws up, he starts singing one of the words before the verse starts, and that's my favorite part of the song. So that was where my head has been, but as an antithesis to that, I'm also a huge fan of like Tony Visconti, Bowie, all these like beautifully, like very, very lush and well thought out records. So it was like, let's try to do one of those. That's where the idea kind of came from.
Does this have kind of more of a glam rock feel to it, would you say?
Yeah, we were totally trying to go for a Tony Visconti record, you know, Mick Ronson, Tony Visconti style.
So you're sitting here with your guitar. I don't want to talk too much longer before getting to hear you play. Now, the album, like we said, is very produced, but you're just here with your guitar. So what are you going to play for us from the album?
Yeah, I was thinking about songs that would fit, and I thought that the song Green Belly would fit. It's about Hollywood or something like that.
Perfect. Just around the corner from Hollywood here.
Yeah, there we go.
Of your eyes that seem
big plan to step right in. He fell down from the sky and knew why he had to win. Yeah, he's gonna make a movie of his entire life. She will cry, she will cry, cry. Oh yeah.
That's Ty Segall performing Green Belly from his new album, Manipulator. And again, I should emphasize, this is sort of NPR unplugged here because the solo versions here, just you and the guitar, it's very different from what we heard on the album.
Yeah, yeah.
So you grew up here in Southern California, and I read you actually went to the Laguna Beach High School, which is famous for the reality show, which is kind of funny with you sitting here and talking to you, because you kind of seem about as much of the opposite of what you see on that show as somebody could imagine.
That show is insane. I knew a lot of those kids. Yeah. I knew most of those kids. They started filming that when I was a junior or a senior. So they filmed my graduation. There's an episode of my graduation.
Can we spot you on a...
Whenever I saw a camera, I was like, get away from me. We would throw water balloons at them, and we were like, get out of here.
Why would you not want to be associated with those people?
Oh, man. I don't know.
Well, having spent some time in L.A. now, you know, I'm a recent transplant, but I can kind of understand how you have so many different styles in your style, because there's everything here.
There's so much. It's cool. Yeah, growing up here, like, got me into noise music, and then I'm from Orange County, so it's like surf music, so I'll have reverb. I've always had reverb on my guitar for some reason. I think it's because of Orange County.
Blame Orange County for the reverb.
Yeah, it's their fault. Yeah, the reverb and the nihilism. Orange County. No, I'm just kidding.
That's Ty Segall. His new album is called Manipulator. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
And can you take us out on one more tune?
Yeah, I'll play one more. Let's see. Okay, this one's called The Feels.
And when I look into your eyes, I realize you're the same as me. Just wanted to be free. And when we look into the skies, we realize just can't be, you'll never be free. And where are your friends? Where are they now? And your family don't need you now. Oh, it's only a dream. Yes, it's only a dream. Pick yourself up, walk down the street, and feel the freaks that you shall meet. They are your family now. They are your family now.
For the week ending August 31st, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Priska Neely, Tom Dreisbach, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, Becky Hersher, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. Patrick Murray is our technical director with technical support from Leo Delagula. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Phil Harrell is senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
And when I look into your eyes, I realize you're the same as me. We'll never be.